There's a strategy to reduce nitrate and phosphorus runoff into Illinois rivers that helps poison the Gulf of Mexico. The plan is going the wrong way, based on the latest report, yet there's hope for change in the ag community. That story just ahead on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm Charlie Schlenker. Go inside the Rivian plant, where how they're building vehicles is just as interesting as what they're building.
You're going to be wowed, because you're going to see a different approach. You're going to see something that is like Google and Toyota had a baby.
Rivian's manufacturing chief, Eric Fields, on how they're balancing three vehicles, thousands of employees, and millions of battery cells. Plus, a test drive of the new R1T pickup truck. And what's up with all the rain? Those stories and a Bloomington Normal News update just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This week, Rivian's Midwest customers will be flocking to Normal to take their first test drive. It's a major milestone now that Rivian's first electric vehicle, the R1T pickup, has moved into commercial production. Those test drives will take place in the shadow of Rivian's manufacturing plant, where it has invested $1.5 billion. Ryan Denham took a tour of the plant and has this report on where all that money was spent.
Rivian manufacturing chief Eric Fields started this week's tour of his massive plant with a bit of a fact check.
Everybody's calling Rivian a startup, and hopefully the impression that you get today is that Rivian is not a startup. We are a true manufacturing OEM.
OEM is Original Equipment Manufacturer, shorthand for a company that makes stuff. During an hour-long tour of the plant, Fields made the case that how Rivian is building its electric vehicles is just as compelling as the vehicles themselves. Sunday's tour comes just 2 weeks after the formal start of production at Rivian, almost 5 years since the mysterious company landed in Bloomington Normal seeking tax breaks to help buy and resurrect the former Mitsubishi plant. The R1T trucks are now in production, with its sport utility vehicle sibling, R1S, expected to move into production itself before December.
So these are all customer vehicles, which is really exciting. To now see the line completely full, knowing that these will actually be going to customers.
Field says the plant runs on an unprecedented combination of vertical integration and connectivity. He says that gives Rivian certain competitive advantages, which it will need to do something incredibly difficult: launch a new car company from scratch during a pandemic.
You'll see something that is like Google and Toyota had a baby. That's what it's going to be like.
Rivian's secret sauce in manufacturing is its vertical integration, according to Fields. He's worked in auto manufacturing for over 20 years, the last 13 with Nissan in Mississippi. Vertical integration means instead of relying on outside suppliers, Rivian makes many of its components in-house. One example, stamping. Rivian acquired 6 presses from the old Mitsubishi plant. Rivian retooled them so they can stamp both steel and aluminum, and Rivian can now stamp almost 300 distinct body parts for its 3 current vehicles. Most OEMs only stamp a few pieces, like those A-class surfaces that a customer sees in the outside. Others don't stamp their own parts at all, relying on a supplier. Rivian's plant is also making ancillary stuff, like its DC fast chargers and the modular kitchen that can be used in a camping trip.
It's a competitive advantage for us because we control our own quality. We can control our own raw material. We can make design changes as we want on the fly. And any of the savings that we make, we get to keep all the savings versus sharing that with a supplier.
Other examples of vertical integration are visible all over the plant, especially on a Sunday when I visited. It's a big construction day for the plants when regular production is on pause. Until now, for example, Rivian has used motors from Bosch, but now it's making plans to build its own motors in-house. Rivian is also scaling up its battery pack production using cells it buys from Samsung.
Inside a pack right now, there's more than 7,000 cells per pack. Eventually, I've got to build almost 30 packs an hour. So if you take 7,000 times 30 an hour, it's a lot. We'll be processing millions and millions of cells through here. So this is adding additional capacity onto the plant to meet the demands.
And that requires space. Rivian has already added about 800,000 square feet to the plant, bringing it to 3.3 million. Field says there are plans to grow to over 6 million square feet in the next few years. That's the size of 60 Walmarts. Rivian plans to expand the south end of the building westward, all the way to Rivian Motorway, to make room for battery and motor work. Rivian also has two storage sites, one nearby on College Avenue and another on Carrick Road in North Normal, that will expand to over 1 million square feet. There remain challenges, though. Many automakers, including Rivian, have struggled to get semiconductors or chips due to pandemic-related supply shortages. Rivian cited that chip shortage in pushing back the start of commercial production from June to September.
We're definitely facing the chip, dealing with the chip shortage as most OEMs, other OEMs have. One advantage we have is we're controlling our own module development. So if you would say, I'll use Nissan as an example because that's what I know. Most of the modules in Nissan come from Hitachi or Bosch or other makers. We are controlling our own design and working with a manufacturer that's building our design for us. So we also control the chip. And as we see different kind of chip shortages, or we have identified chip shortages in the market that are going to be prolonged, we've been able to modify our own design versus having to use a standard module from a supplier. This has given us an advantage of being able to recognize a roadblock, adapt to the roadblock to freeze up the shortage. It's something we monitor on a daily basis and we have teams working on, but it's not something that we're at the mercy of a supplier.
Another challenge is launching three vehicles in rapid succession. The R1T was first. The R1S sport utility vehicle is in a preliminary production stage called tooling trials right now. Fields expects customer vehicles to be in production before December.
That's the dance of keeping the quality high on the R1T, getting the quality ready on the R1S, and keeping those going at the same time.
Rivian is also building electric delivery vans for Amazon, one of its investors. There'll be three sizes, the 500, the 700, the 900. At 500, is the smallest, ideal for more urban environments like European cities or New York or Chicago. The 900 is the largest, akin to a typical UPS truck. To build those, Fields says they've installed some of the world's largest robots ever used in auto manufacturing. That's needed because of the larger body size of the vans. Field says pre-production of the Amazon vans, also called RPVs, starts next month. Rivian aims to deliver 100 of them to Amazon by the end of the year, with some test models already out in the field.
Amazon's very careful about how they make a change during their hot period between October and December. That's, as you can imagine, they have quite a bit of volume going on at that period.
Amazon initially planned to have 10,000 of the new electric vehicles on the road as early as 2022, and all 100,000 of them on the road by 2030. Field says this is the first time an OEM has mass-produced delivery vans at this scale. He says it's usually a very manual, low-rate process. All this complexity is orchestrated by Rivian's connected factory approach to manufacturing. One example is how things are put together on the chassis line.
We do not use what we'll call dumb shooter guns, which is just, we'll say, like a Milwaukee impact driver. None of those exist within our shop. Everything is either Bluetooth and torque controlled, or they use the computer controls to monitor the torque and angle of every single bolt.
Rivian monitors and stores that data. Other incoming data includes the employee who's badged into a workstation, or the downtime or equipment failures at that workstation.
All this information goes into a cloud that we can then monitor all the factory analytics across from zone to zone, plant to plant, and the total plant operation.
A connected factory for what Rivian is building is one of the most connected vehicles on the market. From the Rivian plant in Normal, I'm Ryan Denham.
That's what's happening inside the plant, but there was plenty going on outside the plant when WGLT was invited to Rivian's first mile test drive event. Pre-order customers from all over the Midwest were visiting Normal to take the R1T pickup for a spin around the test track. Ryan Denham got to drive two.
You guys ready?
Yeah. We're ready.
Three, two, one, go.
And 60.
If you're wondering what it feels like to go from 0 to 60 in like 3 seconds, I just experienced that for the first time driving a Rivian R1T. I'm not a car guy, so I'm going to describe what it was like in the layest of layman's terms. 0 to 60? Well, that was kind of like being on a strangely quiet roller coaster where your head gets tossed back into the headrest. Rivian's test track sits just behind the plant, just to the east of it, and it is really on brand. I don't know how often real Rivian owners are going to be driving through dry creek beds or up giant rock hills, but I'm here to say that the R1T can do those things. I took the ride with WGLT's student photographer, Emily Bollinger, who was sitting in the back seat very bravely as we went up that 45-degree rock hill and then back down it.
Oh, my goodness. These guys in the back, check this out. Look out here. Look out here.
Oh, my God.
That's awesome, huh?
Wow.
Once we get down and level it out, we're going to make a complete stop.
The truck is a bit of a shapeshifter. We did 0 to 60 in what's called all-purpose mode, and then my Rivian co-pilot put us into sport mode.
It's going to lower the suspension and give it a little bit more traction and control. You're actually going to feel it lower on its own. Check this out.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Then he fiddled around on the 16-inch display screen on the dashboard and changed modes on us again.
Now I'm going to put you in off-road. Essentially what that is going to do is going to bring the suspension at a higher level.
Okay.
And in that way we have more traction and control on the off-road portion.
And that's what we used to drive over a dry riverbed filled with giant rocks. Bumpy as heck, but again, strangely quiet.
Driving in a dry riverbed.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
No, not intentionally.
WGLT and other media got invites for this Rivian test drive event, and we weren't alone. Also taking a drive around the track on Sunday was Senator Dick Durbin, both Ray and Darren LaHood, and Normal Mayor Chris Koos, among others. I've been covering Rivian for about 3 years. I first saw one in the flesh at a media event up in Detroit, then again a few days later at the LA Auto Show back in 2018. I had never driven one. In fact, I haven't driven any electric vehicle before. So the weirdest sensation for me was when you take your foot off the R1T accelerator, it's pretty wild. The truck slows down like a golf cart. Technically speaking, my Rivian co-pilot told me that it's part of the truck's regenerative braking.
Essentially, when you let go of your accelerator, it's going to decelerate on its own, and this is just a conserved battery life.
As a technology nerd, the coolest part to me was that 16-inch infotainment panel on the dashboard. You can pop the hood or close it with the touchscreen. For those of us who have very short spouses, you can set a driver profile so the seat automatically moves before you ever step in. After all, the truck's starting price is over $67,000, so there are going to be some bells and whistles. And yes, I'm a dork, so I made sure that one essential feature of the truck was working just fine. The radio.
Is this your radio station?
It is.
Yeah.
I work for NPR in town here. So.
Oh, nice. That's awesome.
Reporting from the front seat of a Rivian R1T pickup truck, I'm Ryan Denham.
Coming tomorrow, Denham will have more from the Normal plant, specifically what all those 2,800 people are doing and who else the company is looking to hire. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. After historic flooding in parts of central Illinois this summer, it feels natural to ask, what's up with all this rain? Is it normal to experience the kind of rainfall that has caused widespread damage throughout the region? Or are extreme rain events a relative anomaly? Sarah Nardi reports.
Heavy rainfall is pretty common in Illinois, and the state has had its fair share of extreme rain events. The state record is just over 16 inches in Aurora in 1996. But even in a region known for rain, this summer felt a little extra. As it turns out, when it comes to the feeling that heavy rain is becoming more common, there's some science to support that. Here's state climatologist Trent Ford.
What we've observed with long-term rainfall records, and based on theory, what we expect is that an overall warmer climate would yield, in a climate such as ours, more frequent and more intense rainfall.
And the climate is warming, meaning that extreme rain events like those that inundated Bloomington Normal homes in late June will become more common. Trisha Brownfield was at home in Bloomington as that late June rain fell. It had been raining for hours, so Brownfield, as she usually did, peeked into the basement to check the sump pump. Through the basement window, she could see water rising in her backyard, so high that it started lapping against the glass. She heard a sudden crack and the sound of water rushing towards the steps.
The first time I looked open the basement door again, the water was about halfway. Probably was maybe 15 minutes later, it was close to the top step.
Brownfield knew she needed to leave the house immediately, and with the help of a neighbor, she and her husband rounded up their dog and left. Brownfield knew this flood was different than anything they'd dealt with in the past.
I was the last one to leave the house, and there was a moment that I knew we weren't coming back.
She and her husband stayed overnight with the neighbor and returned the next day to survey the state of the home.
It wasn't until that following morning I saw the damage in the back and knew that, you know, it wasn't just a window, it wasn't a little bit of water. We lost walls.
Brownfield's house was destroyed. When the rains finally stopped, over 10 inches had fallen on the region in a three-day period, earning the rainfall the designation of a 100-year event. But that kind of verbiage can be misleading, according to Ford, and possibly lull people into a false sense of security. Because yes, 100-year rain events are rare.
But that doesn't mean that if you get a 100-year event, you have 100 years to get another one.
Based on current projections, a rainfall like the one that destroyed Tricia Brownfield's home has a 1% chance of occurring in a given year. But as the climate continues to warm and the air holds more water, the potential for heavy rain grows. And those changes are happening exponentially. Just days after the rains that flooded parts of Bloomington Normal, Gibson City saw its own historic rainfall. Parts of the town, located just 30 miles east of Bloomington, recorded up to 11 inches of rain in only a few hours. Those numbers qualified Gibson City rains as a 500-year event.
Within 20 minutes, we had 8 inches.
That's Allison Abel, who had to flee her Gibson City home with her 3 daughters and 2 dogs as her basement quickly filled with water. Before she left, Abel placed some valuables on a mattress in her basement bedroom, hoping the water wouldn't rise above her bed. Abel says those things were saved when the mattress rose like a raft in 7 feet of water. Everything else was gone.
We lost all of our wedding stuff, all of our clothes, all of our daughter's toys, her clothes, and then obviously like washer, dryer, furnace.
Abel says it's been difficult to confront the level of loss her family suffered during the flood. But what's been worse than losing things is losing a sense of security. Abel says her youngest daughter struggled to return home after the flood. Another daughter gets scared when it starts to rain.
I had a message from my middle daughter's teacher saying she was having a hard time when it was raining while they were at school.
Abel says now they practice evacuating the house so that her girls will know what to do in the event of another flood. She says there was just no way to be prepared for the first.
Because this has never happened in Gibson before. Nobody was prepared for this.
Abel's right. There's no precedent in modern record for the rainfall Gibson City experienced in August. Trent Ford says some parts of the area experienced 1,000-year rain.
It's very possible that I could go the rest of my career without seeing a rainfall event like that in Illinois.
But precipitation is changing, Ford says, and so is our risk. As the climate continues to change, extreme rainfalls will become more common. And a town that survives a 1,000-year rain isn't necessarily off the hook for another millennium.
They are just as likely to have one tomorrow as they are 1,000 years from now.
And that's why Allison Abel is preparing her family for the next time, in case they have to live through history again. I'm Sarah Nardi.
Ford says the kind of rain that fell in Gibson City is still rare, but the incidence of rain that can overwhelm urban stormwater drainage systems or overrun creek beds is increasing. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new report on the state strategy to reduce nutrient runoff shows mixed results. The overall amount of measured nutrients actually went up in the last 2 years. So did awareness of the issues surrounding nitrate, phosphorus, and sediment that contribute to the so-called dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. That's an area that doesn't have enough oxygen in the water to support most life. Chris Reynolds is the Midwest Regional Director of American Farmland Trust, an ag environmental group. He says there are several reasons the nutrient loss reduction strategy that came out in 2015 hasn't made more progress.
So the strategy laid out some practices that would help us reduce that nutrient loss. And it laid out a framework for implementing those practices on a lot of corn and soybean acres. So for example, you know, increasing the use of cover crops, you know, getting to somewhere between 30 and 50% of cover crop usage. Cover crops usage has grown. It's been one of the main practices that farmers have been adopting, but not at the rate needed to meet the goals of the strategy. So
if only 64% or so of farmers say they're really well versed in these strategies, whether it's no-till and or cover crops, that doesn't argue for quick adoption.
Yeah, I think really, you know, cover crops, you know, I've been working in conservation for 20 some years, and somewhere around 2012, 2013, you know, we really started focusing on cover crops as an in-field management tool. to prevent erosion. And then the strategy came along. We also recognized that it did a lot for reducing nutrient loss. And now we also recognize it has a lot of other agronomic benefits. So I think the key is, you know, how do we get more farmers, you know, the technical resources that they need? The state, for the first time in many, many years, has increased conservation technical assistance in the form of increased conservation funding through the Illinois Department of Agriculture. And we've been lagging behind a lot of our neighboring states in those areas for many years.
Why is that, do you think? Is it just that the perhaps $10 an acre reduction in net returns on farmland is too significant for farmers to want to adopt?
I think you know, it comes with a need for additional management. And I think that is really, you know, one of the factors, one of the challenges is that cover crops and no-till are practices that take additional management. It's not near as easy as just going out and performing tillage in order to get the soil ready to plant. There has to be a little more patience. There has to be more management. We have to, you know, right now we're in the middle of harvest and our focus is on getting the crops in from the fields. But we also have to make time for planting cover crops, and that can certainly be a challenge.
Part of the reason for increasing measured amounts of nitrates and phosphorus in the water is the increase in the last several years in total water flow. Is there any way around that variability, or is that just how much is going to wash out because it's mobile? All of these nutrients are mobile.
Yeah, well, I think that's the other factor. You know, our trajectory isn't going to help us, you know, meet the goals of the strategy, but then you also throw in, you know, part of that strategy was based on, you know, current rainfall amounts, and you look at, you know, what the report shows and such a big increase in the amount of water leaving the state of Illinois. So we're also dealing with increased rainfall events, more intense, more frequent rainfall events. And so that's making it even more challenging.
What would you like to see happen in the next, by the next biennial report and maybe over the next 5 years? What needs to happen?
I think we have to see much greater growth. We have to see more than a 1 to 2% increase in the adoption of cover crops and the adoption of no-till. We need to see more like a 5 to 8% increase, you know, over a 2-year time period. I don't think the industry, the cover crop industry, can handle a jump in 30% increase in order to keep up with seed supply and things of that nature. So I think the growth has to be strategic. We have to be providing the farmers with the technical assistance they need so that if they are adopting the practices, they're successful with the practices.
Chris Reynolds is the Midwest Regional Director of American Farmland Trust and Ag Environment Group. The nutrient reduction strategy calls for a 15% drop in nitrate runoff and 25% in phosphorus by the year 2025 and a 45% reduction in both by 2045. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.